You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Hello, and welcome to this podcast, Managing Neuromyelitis Optica Spectrum Disorders. How can you achieve long-term relapse-free outcomes in practice? I'm Deb Gordon, and I'm thrilled to be joined by Samira Ahmed, founder of the Samira Foundation, an organization dedicated to generating global awareness of NMOSD and myelin oligodendrocyte, glycoprotein antibody-associated disease, or MOGAD. In this podcast, she will discuss the challenges people with these ocular conditions face. Welcome, Samira.
Thanks for having me, Deb.
It's very impressive that you've started this foundation. Before we get into that, tell us about your journey to diagnosis and how did that come about?
Sure. So I'm actually celebrating what I refer to now as my NMOversary this summer. So it's been 9 years living with this disease. And my journey started in 2014, a few weeks before my 25th birthday. I was working and living in Boston, where I still am, and working in ophthalmology, actually, which is the irony of it all, when I lost my vision very suddenly. And because I worked in ophthalmology and I worked with so many doctors, I was able to be evaluated almost right away. So during my first episode, I was, I'm giving you a very abridged version, but basically I had an eye exam where I worked. It was, you know, the doctors were able to see that I couldn't see out of my right eye. I had a pretty severe visual field deficit in my right eye, but structurally they couldn't find anything wrong. So, the next step was to get an MRI. So it was 4th of July weekend, 2014.
Oh, great.
Exactly. Where all the residents and fellows are brand new. All the attendings are on their much deserved vacations. But that's when I went in and I was scheduled to have an outpatient MRI at 9 in the morning. I showed up with my weekend bag, thinking, oh, I'm going to be in and out for this MRI. And then I'm going to go to my 4th of July barbecue. Obviously, that is not what happened. I ended up being in the emergency room for about 14 hours. I saw all kinds of specialists, all people who were scratching their heads wondering, like, why is this young, otherwise healthy young woman losing vision so rapidly? So finally, I had my MRI, my very first one, and what they were able to see was that there was inflammation in the optic nerves and the chiasm, and that's what was causing the vision loss. So I got admitted right away and they started IV steroids. When I was discharged, I was diagnosed with idiopathic optic neuritis and it was just in the right eye. I was told that I had a 16% chance of developing multiple sclerosis at some point in my life, but that I should move on, you know, take vitamin D supplements and that my vision would return within 3 months to a year. So, you know, being as young and naive as I was, that's what I tried to do, except 3 weeks later, pretty rapidly, I lost vision in both my eyes, started feeling all kinds of strange sensations in my body. And to make a long, long, long story short, I was rushed to the hospital, got all kinds of tests, poked and prodded, imaging, lumbar puncture, blood taken, and it was determined that I had seronegative neuromyelitis optica.
Let me go back to that episode. Well, let me go back to you being discharged. You were discharged and you still had no vision in the right eye.
Yeah.
And you were saying you just had these weird sensations. Can you describe them a little more?
Absolutely. So I was feeling burning sensations in my hands and my feet and some parts of my extremities I couldn't even feel anymore. I also had this horrible, horrible headache and pain in the back of my neck. I was very nauseous. And because of how bad my vision got, I was incredibly disoriented too. So, you know, I have these like blacked out portions of my eye. So loss of peripheral vision, but then also in my right eye, I regressed from 20/20 to 2600 almost overnight, and then my left eye 21/20.
Wow, that's unbelievable. So you are rushed to the hospital. What happens next?
So I rushed to the hospital, and then I got 4 hours of MRI, now top to bottom. I had 20 vials of blood collected. My first lumbar puncture. Oh, it was horrible. And they started me on IV steroids right away. And of course, I was admitted right away. And it was, I think, the second day of IV steroids, a team of doctors came in and they said, we want to talk to you about something we think that you have. And that was the first time that I had ever heard neuromyelitis optica. And I remember so vividly, even on all the pain meds I was on, this moment I remembered, because you just can't forget it. It almost, like, hearing that alone, I think, paralyzed me. And it was so debilitating to hear this mouthful of a diagnosis at 25 when you think you're invincible and totally, you know, okay. And my first question was, am I going to die from this? And there was almost like a dead silence in the room, because in 2014, NMO is very different than it is now.
There was like nothing for it.
I mean, we had no FDA approved therapies. The mortality rate was much higher. The misdiagnosis rate was higher. I was on the precipice of being misdiagnosed with MS. I mean, I consider myself to be very lucky. I was early detection saves lives. And I think I'm a very good example of that. But yeah, the situation was very different. And, you know, people weren't talking about it the way they're talking about it now. So it was almost like getting a death sentence, but it could have been a slow one or could have been a fast one. No one really could tell me anything much more than that.
What happened next? I guess they stabilized you, and obviously you haven't died, which is good.
Yeah, so, exactly. So I ended up being in the hospital that visit. So that was like when I was diagnosed, probably around 9 days. I got IV steroids for 5 days. I started my first immunosuppressive therapy. And I love to tell this story just because hopefully it shines some light on how much we've done as a community over the years. But when I was discharged from the hospital, and this was Mass General Hospital, one of the top hospitals in the world, excellent care, I asked the discharge nurse, I said, so what am I going home with? You know, like, how do I kind of live with all of this? So she gave me a list of prescription medications that I would be taking. It was a laundry list. She gave me a list of outpatient appointments. I was now having to see all kinds of specialists, a list of all my infusion appointments. And then she gave me this lovely, very helpful handout that just outlined like all the foods you must avoid when on prednisone so that you don't gain weight. And of course, as a 25-year-old young woman, I was very grateful for that. But I was like, okay, nurse, but what about, you know, Samira's head and heart? You know, how do I find other patients? Do you guys have support group meetings? Is there a celebrity with this? Is there a foundation with this? Anything? And, you know, the discharge nurse, not that it was her job, but, you know, it was alarming to me that she had no idea. She was like, I don't know. I mean, I guess look on Google. So I went home. I was in bed rest for 3 weeks. I looked up NMO on Google, and I was mortified to find what was on the internet. And that what was
very low.
Yeah. I mean, the first thing you saw was you have a life expectancy of a maximum of 5 years. That's not what you want to hear as a newly diagnosed 25-year-old woman. And it was difficult to find other patients. It was difficult to find what I felt I needed at the time and what I needed to help me sort of pick up the pieces and move on with my life as best as I could with these new circumstances. And so when I was, you know, Googling all of this, those first couple of weeks after diagnosis, I realized, like, oh boy, there is a huge gap here and maybe I can do something about it.
And so, you know, 25 years old, have this potentially fatal disease, you're like, let me start a foundation.
Basically, because I said I have, looks like I don't have that much time and I have nothing to lose. And in addition to helping myself, maybe I can help somebody else too, even if I was one other person that I could help. I really just did not want anyone to go through what I went through in terms of how lonely I felt, how isolating the experience was, despite having so many people around me all the time. But not really having people around you or people to talk to who know and live with this is a very different experience.
So how did you get the word out, and how many people do you have involved with the foundation now?
So I will say social media was the primary vehicle for reaching out to patients for, I would say it still is in many ways, over the last 9 years. What a powerful, powerful tool. Of course, there are pros and cons to social media, but I would say for rare diseases, it's incredibly helpful. So I used Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, Twitter to find patients, caregivers, doctors, researchers, advocates. And then eventually it was through social media that a lot of the therapeutic partners that we now work with found me. And I was in that generation where social media was like, you know, I wouldn't say I grew up with it, but like my formative years is when social media really started gaining momentum. So in some ways I felt like, oh, this is perfect. I know how to use this. I studied PR at university. I went to BU at Boston, and I was like, let me see if I can use this to, you know, make some stuff happen. And so here we are 9 years later, and I'm still alive. So that's fun. But, you know, our reach now is in the thousands, which is just unbelievable. And I would say between volunteers, contractors, staff, the foundation now works with close to 100 people around the world.
That's awesome. That's really great. So tell us, in the past 9 years, besides being super busy setting up the foundation and spreading awareness, what is it like to live with this disease?
It's not easy, but it also is very, it comes in phases. So, you know, for me, it's been almost 10 years, which it's mind-boggling because sometimes it feels like so much longer, and sometimes it feels like it just happened yesterday. The first few years were incredibly tough for me. I mean, so tough to the point that I really looked into some extreme measures to end my own misery and agony. Part of that challenge was that I did continue to test negative for the aquaporin 4 antibody, and nothing definitive in terms of biomarkers ever showed up. So for a long time, I thought, oh, maybe this isn't real, or, you know, maybe I'm imagining things, or no one's ever going to know how to treat this. And I had failed all the different therapies that they were trying on me and experimenting on me. So it was very challenging. New symptoms kept coming up. New ideas started coming up all the time. So yeah, the first 4 years were incredibly challenging. I was living in a constant state of fear, anxiety, anger, frustration, all while building a foundation and trying to give other people hope. But then once I got into a groove and got on a therapy that really worked for me, things started to get better. So I would say over the last, like since 2019, I've been relatively stable. And I guess considered in remission. But it's still not easy. You know, every day is different and you feel things that are difficult to explain and things that the naked eye can't see. So it's hard to always communicate how you're feeling and for people to truly get how you're feeling. So oftentimes, oh my gosh, I've never said this out loud, Deb, but oftentimes I just like pretend everything is okay because it's almost easier that way.
So sort of if you, yeah, pretend, then it'll be real.
Yeah.
What do you hear from other people with the disease that you've talked to? How are their experiences the same or different?
Oh, I mean, so that's why it's now called a spectrum disorder, because everybody's experiences are so different and there are so many different variables for why people's experiences are the way they are, some of which could be where you live in the world, some of which could be, you know, just access to healthcare and navigating the healthcare system, not speaking English or living in a place where they don't really have specialists and whatnot. So there definitely are a number of us who are in the same boat of, okay, we were diagnosed early, we got on therapy early, and our quality of life for the most part was salvaged, or we were able to maintain some quality of life without changing or altering too much. But of course, you hear these stories of patients who weren't so lucky and they were misdiagnosed sometimes for decades, or, you know, given the wrong therapy for years and years and years, which made their situation much worse. And they had to sacrifice their careers, their education, their aspirations, their family situations completely changed. So it's all over the map. It's, I'm in this position where, of course, it's great to hear the success stories, and I love to hear that and share them. But I also hear really horrible stories as well.
So let me ask you one last question, because our time is almost up, but most of the people listening to this are clinicians. What message do you have for them coming from your perspective?
I would say that we are very fortunate to have specialists and key opinion leaders, and as many as we do, who care so much about these diseases and their patients, but obviously not enough. So we need more. And listen to your patients. Just give them the space and the allowance to talk about what's going on with them, because oftentimes these appointments, sometimes it's not even in the doctor's control, are rushed, and people feel intimidated to share how they're actually feeling, or feel that they don't have the time to share what's going on and their symptoms and what have you. So I think if we can create environments in the clinical setting, especially during follow-ups or new patient exams or whatever, for the patient to feel and the caregivers to feel comfortable and empowered to speak up and say what's going on and have an open, honest, and vulnerable, trusting relationship with their doctors, that will have benefits on the patient's journey with the disease.
Beautifully said. And how can people find the foundation?
So you can definitely visit our website. It's www.samirafoundation.org. All of our content is now available in 15 languages, and it is fully accessible. And of course, we're on social media. You can follow the foundation on Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, and subscribe to our YouTube channel.
And just so everybody knows, that's spelled S-U-M-A-I-R-A. Well, thank you so much for sharing all that and being so honest and open about the challenges you and others have faced. And I want to thank our listeners for joining us. We hope you'll listen to the other episode of this series. This podcast was brought to you by Med Learning Group. Med Learning Group is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education to provide CME for physicians. This CME activity was planned and produced in accordance with the ACCME Essentials. I want to give a special thank you to our supporter, Genentech, who provided an educational grant for this activity.